Well, our lesson tonight doesn't fit the lesson plan, but it does fit here historically, and I didn't want to go by J.N. Darby in the setting where his ministry occurs, or I should say starts, because it parallels the Second Great Awakening. And I made a statement up here. It says, there is no material connection between Darby and the Great Awakenings. That's why I say this is, you know, I don't know. If there is a connection, I don't know what it would be. I mean, he may have been aware of things, but there's no cause and effect here with him or with the Great Awakening and him. For one thing, he's in Ireland most of the time, or in England. He is in the United States during the end of this time some. But so this is an odd lesson. So I had to keep reminding myself in my preparation why I'm doing this. So if I had to remind me all the time why I'm doing this, I'd have to remind you why we're doing this. It's because it fits in history here. And if we come back and do it later, then it would seem like it's kind of out of position and you wouldn't get the impact of what else is going on in the world during the Great Awakening that's not studied at the time of the Great Awakening. But J.N. Darby and the contribution he makes to dispensational premillennialism is unparalleled in church history. He recovers what I have up here is called the leaks. He recovers the leaks that have been going on since the early church and does it, in a sense, single-handedly with the Bible in his hand and his mind in the other, and puts together the system that we are benefactors of. And it may be interesting to find each of us are, I thought about that a little in my own life, where this information, you know, I grew up in a dispensational church, how this connection was made to the people that taught me and so forth. So each one has your own story. But the legacy that Darby left is absolutely incredible. And the grief he's gotten for doing it has been incredible. So we're going to do him tonight. And the storyline up here is basically the Abrahamic covenant is an unconditional, unilateral, literal, eternal covenant with Abraham and his descendants through Jacob. And I put that up there as a bar. There's no changing of it. There is an obedience aspect of it, but not in terms of its the contract itself. In fact, on Sunday morning, I'm doing a series on the Bible as a contract to underscore the fact that the Bible gives the Abrahamic covenant is a contract, just as bona fide, enforceable as any other contract is. And we sometimes look at what's in the Bible as not a contract. It's sort of good ideas, some suggestions, some devotional thoughts. You know, there's something quite fluid, and the Bible is not that at all. It's very, very specific, highly oriented towards a promise and a promise-keeping God that enforces it. So we want to think about the Abrahamic covenant as a contract. There's nothing wrong with that. Some might say that's too unspiritual, but that's what it is. God entered into a contract with Abraham, not that he had to participate as a participant in the contract, except he's just the receiver of the benefits of it. So in that sense, he enters into a covenant with Abraham, a contract with Abraham. And this shouldn't be unusual for us because we think about the Old and New Testaments, which is the Old and New Covenant. Another word for covenant is contract. Another word some suggest use the word agreement. All these words are really meaning the same thing. So when we come to what God has said and what he has promised, it is a contract, and that is what's being challenged over these years. So that's what's up here. We have three places. You have the rejection of the Gentiles of the Jewish promises. We have, first of all, I just call it the personal rejection. In other words, individual Jews are sort of ruled out as Christ killers. That would be the term they'll use later. And since God has given up on Israel by destroying the temple and in 35, he destroys the city. Since God's given up on the Jews, we should do the same and do God a favor to help him out a little bit. So that's at the first level. And then we have another level with Constantine, who, by the way, we're coming up on Easter here. He's the one that changed the Easter date off of the Passover date so that he said, we're not going to share this holiday with the odious people, the Jews. So I think that the elders should change their view now and start having Easter on Passover as an apologetic to the Jews, because that's what it would be. Can you imagine they're stirred in the same? They don't even watch. They don't even observe Easter anymore. Wow. But anyway, so Easter is meant to be off of the Jewish Passover day. Constantine made sure of that because they thought, sure, that the millennial kingdom was starting with him. The Romans were going to be in charge, and that lasted until Rome fell. Then Augustine had to change that. So we have these leakage that goes on with the 325 with Constantine. With the leakage, there is the nation. The national promises are gone officially now because it's a world empire has declared their persona non grata. And then we have Augustine. Augustine comes along. This isn't really a slap on the Jews, but it's a slap on the kingdom because he thought, well, if it's not going to be a Jewish kingdom, then it's going to be a Gentile kingdom. Now, we're still talking earthly kingdom. We're talking about premillennialism. But when he saw Rome fell, he said, well, wait a minute. I must have been drinking the Kool-Aid because this kingdom is really not on earth. After all, it's in the spiritual realm. And he buys into this Hellenistic Greek idea of where heaven is, where we get away from the material world and we go into the space where the real reality is. So he adopts a spiritualized view of the kingdom. And so that's the last part. Now, real interesting, this whole idea needs a theology. You know, it needs to have a coherent theology put together by somebody that could explain from the Bible or from wherever you're going to get it from to explain how this works. Well, that didn't happen until we have Cocesius. He died in 1669, so let's guess around 1650, is where he came up with what we call covenant theology, where God enters into a covenant with man, and that was with Adam. Adam fails, therefore God entered into a second covenant with Adam, which is a covenant of grace, which he cannot fail. So this is where this all started, and then all these ideas of that the Abrahamic covenant is a conditional and is no longer in effect, all goes out the window because now God has made a covenant with man through Adam, through his descendants, through those that have faith like Abraham. Those are the ones that are the people of God. And the Jews are persona non grata. They're not even on the radar scope anymore. And they're gone. So it took Cocesius to develop that theology, which is still being taught wherever there's covenant theology. They will revere him as the father of covenantalism. So with that, I'll dismiss with a word of prayer. Well, not quite. I won't let you get away with that. So we're down here with Darby. He was born in 1800, died 1882, so not too hard to remember. And his mark was made around 1828, 1830, probably 29, somewhere in there. And I'll say this later on, but basically when he had figured this out, he was a convalescent in his sister's home after he got thrown from a horse. When he was in this convalescing stage, he probably, first of all, came to true faith, although he'd been a minister, came to true faith here and pretty well puts together the theology that we have. Now, there's some arguments about that and where did he get it from and all that kind of stuff. We'll talk about that. But probably get down to shaking it all out. That's probably where he got it, and it just didn't change all that much after this time. So we have this very important period of 1828, and remember our studies were in 1776 America. We had the French Revolution 1789, American Revolution 1776. So we're into the early American age, early American life, and he's in Ireland, not in America. So, but remember the awakenings also were in England as well as in America. So the awakening went across the river, so to speak, but I think the second great awakenings are mostly American. Okay, so that's where he fits, and that's why we're doing it now, because it's in that list. So we have this lesson, what I call in the recovery of New Testament theology, and America is going to have to wait. We're going to put him where he belongs, so you see we're a little bit ahead, but we're about the time when he was born. One of the books on the right hand is The Roots of Fundamentalism by Ernest Sandeen, not a believer as far as I'm concerned. He's now deceased. Probably the best book of all that I have on the subject of fundamentalism. And fundamentalism is also almost described as dispensationalism. They're almost synonymous. They aren't really, but they are almost. And he bemoans the fact that there is not a good biography of Jan Darby available. And so we have one now by Paul Wilkerson, and he comes to the Preacher Conference every year. And we have this at the bookstore. It is the best book, most thorough book on Jan Darby that there is. And so we have Mr. Sandeen's hope satisfied with Wilkerson's book. He's an English guy. So this chart is basically to show you what I did here. In my mind, I didn't know how the best to show it. That's what I wanted to do with the leak eeds, but I took it instead steps down. So these are the kind of the leaky spots that I put on the board. And I have the personal rejection, national rejection, then the Hellenization of Christianity, which is mostly in the eschatology, the latter times. And then we have this stair step back. And with Jan Darby, it's almost one leap. You know, it goes from nothing to in one leap. So that's kind of what I want to show here with this chart. And in the top here, we have the Great Awakenings that are going on. And the main line is my main line on top there. It is the consistent statement about the covenant of Abraham, unconditional, unilateral, literal, and eternal. It doesn't change. And there are those that will hold that to be true. And so those are the faithful church. So when I present these that have fallen off, that are leaked away, that doesn't mean they all were. But in terms of the main current, they were all guilty of it except for an exception. So we're going to pause in our progress over the Second Great Awakening study to review a missing gear. I'm a mechanical guy. Missing gear in a drive chain, or for those of you that cook, and that can be some of you guys, the leaky mixing bowl, which holds ingredients of the prize-winning dish together. You know, either a gear or something is missing, an important thing. This deficiency has dogged our study all along, and if we would have started before 1620, before the pilgrims, we would find that the essential truth has been missing for centuries. Now, we would go back, clear back, almost to the cross, where the animosity between the Christians and Jews started, probably around 70 AD mostly. So in our other studies, we have pointed out that because of the missing truth, the church has floundered to find her place in God's program. I'm not sure the church out there really knows why they're here. Now, this has resulted in a foggy outlook that has caused the church to make colossal mistakes in essaying their actions and purposes. So remember, I started this series with why Mary Dyer must die. And she must die because she is a heretic. And heretics do not have the privilege of living any longer. And where do they get that idea from? Well, they get it out of reading the law. Well, why do they read the law? Because they think they're the new Israel. And the new Israel must be obedient to the law. So it totally makes sense if you're the new Israel. So don't tell me that they don't get off track and they don't have dire consequences. That they hung about four people in relatively short succession before they got their, you know, came to the senses, I guess, and said, well, we're going to disobey the law rather than kill some more people. But the system for it is in place still today. They have not forsaken their new Israel status. So with the truth missing, the truth is missing that the church is not Israel, that truth. With the truth missing, in its place, the church assumes the new Israel, who is devoted to making the world a better place by all means or any means. And that is kind of where the church has struggled to find an identification. Now, we put ourselves above the line. We call ourselves the faithful church. The salt and light comes out of the gospel. Does not necessarily apply directly to the church, but it does apply to the believer. He is the salt and light in the world. And these have not rejected the Jews. So in their salt and light in that sense. And so those that are below the line would be the self-righteous church. They are saying, come join us and change the world. That's kind of their motto. And they look across the line and look at us and say, you're so heavenly minded, you're no earthly good. So this argument does go on. So they look at us being useless, and they're asking us to join them in this quest to change the world. Now, this deviation comes crystal clear as we move into the 19th century. As the church finds her moral legs, she goes to work on society with a vengeance to clean up culture. Starting with slavery, it's always the big one, drinking alcohol, the prohibition days, women's voting rights, and a few other women's things, I guess, Sabbath keeping, and whatever seems immoral, I say seems immoral, and inhibits the progress to a perfected society. Remember, we're still post-millennial. Now, this activity can be called the tyranny of the good because it ignores the duty of the righteous. Now, the bad thing is always to do something that's good instead of doing the right thing. So this is doing a good thing, but not the righteous thing. They're caught into that with their lack of identification of the church. So the missing gear or the leaking bowl is recognizing that the promises of God are connected to the people of God, by the strength of a sovereign choice, which we call an election. That's what holds it in place. God made an election of Abraham and telegraphed his commitment to his family through Jacob. At the end of history, in God speak, that is until the end of forevers of forevers. There's never an end of this. Just get that in our heads. It would help. Now we pause with another irony here. Those who hold to a divine sovereign election of an individual for salvation, which cannot be undone, find themselves denying the same divine election in the call of Abraham. They become Arminian. And boy, do they hate to think that. They say that we the elect, the believers are the elect, we cannot fail. And they give us the 5 points of Calvinism to show that is true, according to them. But they say that the elect can fail, as in the failure of Abraham. So I ask, which is it? Is the election irrevocable? Cannot be changed. So I'd say yes to that question. But why will God remain faithful when the elect is a Christian, but if the elect is Abraham, God, in secret, withdraws it? So when God does everything open with us, you know, our salvation is guaranteed, and they're really strong in election and sovereignty of God. But when it comes to Abraham, all of a sudden he's on his own. He's an Arminian guy, and Abraham's failed so badly, God's going to withdraw his election. Now, I suppose they're going to go back and say that the election is not really an election. It's really not a contract. But boy, the burden of proof is on them to show that it's not. But for uneducated people in the Bible, they say, well, it's not, therefore it's not. And they give kind of a flimsy excuse why it's not, and they go on. So, Gentile pride is breathtaking. Are we to think that God is gracious and forgives the sins of the sinning believer, but Christians who have been elected do not grant the same privilege to Abraham and insist that God revoke Abraham's election? This is like a refugee who has just received a care package but denies it to the guy behind him. I got mine, you can't have yours. What greater ingratitude can there be that the Christian has his election, but Abraham is denied his? So we have interrupted our study, the Second Great Awakening, to point out the historic recovery of this missing link that's accepted from early days in the church in the Christian theology. The election of Abraham. That's what's missing. Now, this is a quote from a guy by DeProse, great book on replacement theology on the right side of the issue. The absence of Israel in much of Christian theology has a long history. It goes back way almost to the cross. During the formative years of the Christian tradition, this reflected the view that what was promised to Israel finds his ultimate fulfillment in Jesus. I've had a guy tell me that. Would you rather not have Jesus than the land? Remember? The Israelite par excellence. Can't disagree with that. Or the church. No, wait a minute. I thought, whoa. Those are two different things. So we're going to decide it's one of these others. I mean, if we're going to be on the right track, it only can be one of these things. Covenant theology can't have two of these choices. Well, it could be the church or it could be Jesus. Which is it? I guess it depends what argument you need. So this is a clue already to me that is off the track. If you're on the right track, you don't have two answers here. So is it Jesus or the church? Well, it follows that the church completely and permanently replaces ethnic Israel in the working out of God's plan and as recipient of the Old Testament promises addressed to Israel, they say. So I really think that they really think that the church is been fulfilled in the church, not in Jesus, because having fulfilled in Jesus, as this my friend told me, says, boy, that's really hard to expect. How do you funnel everything that the Old Testament says about Israel into one person? Unless you just, you know, destroy any meaning to anything. Anyway, that's from DeProse. So last week, we looked at the prophecy hysteria that surrounded the French Revolution, 1789. So much innocent blood was shed by the guillotine that people ran to the Bible to find some rationale for the carnage. Why is it surprising that even though the text of the Bible can be ignored for 1,500 years, but when time comes dire, when time becomes dire outcomes, the literal Bible is pulled off the shelf. All of a sudden, what has been denied for over 1,000 years, amillennialism, springs back to life in the form of postmillennialism. And they read something in the Bible, literally. Well, it seemed that Napoleon, this is during the Revolution, understood the missing link. We talked about our class this morning about how that Napoleon released the pressure on the Jews and made them normal citizens. Well, it may seem that Napoleon understood the missing link when he gave the Jews equal status in the French in his French dictatorship. While he may have held the Jews in some kind of mysterious tension, he did not restore the Jews to their elective status as found in the Abrahamic Covenant. It was only a short time, maybe 10, 15 years, when the Jews were back where they started, so much for the Grand Enlightenment that remained the dark period. Now, we said last week that you cannot avoid the millennialism, you cannot avoid the millennium. It's in Revelation 26 times. So the Christians over time floated all kinds of trial balloons or trial millenniums to see if one might just take off. One lead balloon that still hangs around today is the denial of any millennium. You know, even in the denial, you have to deal with the millennium. It's that there's no millennium. Well, I don't believe in a millennium. Well, you're still talking about it. You know, you can't avoid the millennium. If you deny it, you still got to talk about it. So one lead balloon that still hangs around today is denial of any millennium by making all prophesied events history. I should emphasize history. This is known as preterism, which is the idea that it's past. So, but preterism is a form of amillennialism. All prophesied events are already past. And there's a lot on the internet on this stuff. There's a lot of people are into preterism these days. I guess you get tired of one thing, you go to another thing somehow. Somehow they think that the destruction of the earth as in the tribulation happened in 70 AD, and the way I understand it was pretty much around Jerusalem, but somehow it stretches to the entire earth. You know, the Bible talks about the whole earth, but it's just in Jerusalem. So I guess when you're not literally understanding the Bible literally, you don't need to have it mean anything literally, so it can be the whole earth, I guess. So the axiom is true. Just look at the internet. You can't avoid the millennium. Just look at the internet for sites that deny or confirm or alter the idea of the millennium. They just can't leave it alone. I'll give you a website there. I think this seemed to be a pro-preterist website. Spends its space showing that preterism was present in the post-apostolic second century church. And I said, so what? It probably was there. Probably other silly things were there. So it makes little difference what the early church fathers believed, does it really? Although it is an interesting subject, but to base one's theology on it is more than just dangerous. See, for instance, baptismal regeneration, infant baptism, anti-Semitism, Bible as allegory, especially bad when you can consult the literal scriptures. It teaches against all these heresies. Well, I have called the so-called church fathers church juveniles, and I think maybe some have thought I was doing that in derision and out of disrespect, but I don't need to do that because they were at the beginning of formulating church doctrine. That's why they're juveniles. They're beginners. They're like teenagers. They're starting out on their own without help from the apostles, and they made some serious mistakes and ought not to be used as any authority over Scripture. Now, we'll meet Darby soon, but to note here his evaluation of them. It says, untrustworthy on every fundamental subject. He said the reformers did not fare much better in his estimation. So when you hear these people quote these historic theologians, just give them a little bit of laugh. Why would you trust them instead of the Bible? Just go back a few more years, you got the Bible. Well, he goes on to say here, that this is Darby, I avow I could not tie myself to any of the ancients, those church fathers, nor own their authority in any way. Now, I see Luther, an energy of faith for which millions of souls ought to be thankful to God, and I can certainly see I am. I may see the cleverness and the recognition of the authority of the Scriptures in Calvin, which delivered him and those he taught from the corruptions and superstitions which had overwhelmed Christendom. But present these to me as a standard of truth, I reject them with indignation. They are not inspired. Their teachings are not the word of God. Now, in covenantals, this would be heresy. You know, but it's true. It's true. These guys are stopping off at these ancients and not going back to the scriptures and letting these ancients describe what the scriptures mean. So Darby is on my team right now. So Darby described the 39 articles of the Westminster Confession, the faith, as poor protection for the faith of God's elect, being elastic enough to admit many novel doctrines and all manner of evil ones. By the way, the Westminster Divines, it was done somewhere in the mid-1600s. And the Westminster Confession is still a big deal. And this Darby says it's elastic enough to admit many novel doctrines, like infant baptism, you know, all that kind of stuff. Now, the First Great Awakening began 1739, suffered under the cloud of the rejected Judaism. The idea that the Jews ought to be restored to the land was gaining currency with some of the Puritans, who not talk much about this, but there were some that did. The English Bible caused the recovery of lost knowledge of Jewish prophecy, particularly when Henry VIII published it. He had his own personal Bible. But to Jonathan Edwards and George Whitfield and most of the others, the Jewish question remained answered in the voice of the church fathers. The Jews are savable, but they have no national future. And I don't really think they spent any time on this issue at all that I'm aware of. Well, the French Revolution have two vantage points. The French Revolution had two vantage points. One was the enlightened man had gained knowledge independent of revelation. That's why it's called enlightenment. Based on common sense and the discoveries of science. This made revelation from God unnecessary, and because of a variety of interpretations, rather useless, according to them. Now, Mr. Hawking says, not anymore, but he said this, before we understood science, it was natural to believe that God created the universe. But now science offers a more convincing explanation. And then he died. All right, on one side we have Thomas Paine and his common sense stuff, which was underlying a lot of our founding of our government. Variety of interpretations of the Bible is basically useless. Now, that was when science became the new objective standard. Now, this you don't realize, maybe we don't think about this, how important science discoveries were and how powerful they were. When they could start explaining things and seeing things that didn't know were there through microscopes and measuring distances and understanding the planets and how they worked, all this kind of stuff, and mathematics that was underlying all this, you know, it was a marvel. Now, we would say, isn't it wonderful what God has put together? No, they saw this as a natural machine, nature, machine without God, and it's just something that now you worship because, you know, it's infallible. And the scientists who were fallible read the infallible machine and made some fallible remarks. So this idea that science somehow now competes was very, very common. Okay, that's one vantage point, the enlightened man. The other vantage point saw the catastrophe of putting fallen man in charge of things. There was blood everywhere. Remember the French Revolution? These ran to the Bible, these that were historicists, to make sense of the killings. The corrupted Roman Church with the Pope had been the target of derision for many years. And later, the Reformation, 1517 leaders, too, saw the Pope as the Antichrist and the Roman Church as the false religion. Then, with the French Revolution, someone figured out that 42 months or 60 days, our Daniel 9, were really years, not days. So converting them, we find out that the first Pope, it's not the first Pope, I forget what it is, I got it in front here, and that's something I don't want to even go through this, but they figured out a pope where somehow that something bad happened to him, and that for the next 1260 years, Roman Church dominated, and then at the French Revolution, of course, the French Revolution threw the Catholics out for a bit, and so they figured that was the beginning of the millennium. So now we are not the coming of Christ, it's when the millennium begins. So then the advancement goes from the French Revolution on. So that's really what we have here, and it's sort of a new, fresh, powerful look as post-millennialism. So as I said, it was not Christ's return they were looking at, but it was the scheme of things that was the revival and the improvement that would come in the millennium, after which, post-millennial, the Lord would return. So this is the reverse of pre-millennialism, where the Lord returns before the 1,000 years. I'm going to skip these couple of pages here because this just goes into the Catholic stuff and it makes no sense, you know, but they see things in history and they peg, well, that's this and that's that, and they don't worry about all the rest that doesn't fit. If they just get two parts that fit, then the rest don't matter. So that's how they kind of did this. So the tribulation is sensed in the French Revolution. It appears to the British, across the creek, that they were in the days of the tribulation and the coming of the millennium, not the second advent, was at hand. Now, this too was misguided, as were the Americans, as we will see better. Ahead for the Americans was the Civil War, the continuing nifty wars of Teddy Roosevelt, the great wars of World War I, World War II, and the never-ending wars against communism, the Russian variety, the Chinese threats, or otherwise the Asian ones. Now, all the wars with the Islamic hordes, I mean, there's no getting better here. And by this time, they've given up their post-millennialism. But at the time, at the French Revolution, this was all hope it's going to get better. Now, from our perspective, there are two things that come out of the French Revolution that you might say is a good thing or heading us in the right direction. There were two theological benefits gained by the Revolution. First was to look again at Bible prophecy. Even though they got it messed up, it's a good thing to look at the Bible rather than not look at it. So they started looking at the Bible, made some mistakes, but they were looking at the Bible. And the second thing is they see the Jews again in prophecy. Let's go through these. Okay, the first provided the opportunity to look again at the prophetic text. Now remember, they had it available now, especially the British. And to revisit the ideas of unfulfilled prophecy, especially. And then the second, as it relates to the Jews and the irrevocable Abrahamic covenant. Of course, anything to come out of the 19th century investigation, it will take an honest reading of the text, something that has been neglected since the notorious church fathers. So as a last resort, read the text for what it says. Now, we might say that's easy to do, but when you have a culture that disdains the reading of the text that way, and you start doing it that way, it's just, I don't know what it would be like, how to explain it to you, but it'd be just the opposite of what you think. Maybe it's almost like we'd tell us we've got to read it allegorically. Oh, no, you can't do that. But when we're telling them they got to read their Bibles literally, they say, oh, you can't do that, it's allegory. So you see there's some pushback here, and it wasn't easy. And there's a lot of ridicule that goes on. Ridicule a liberal Bible. Well, I'm a practical guy. I buy a watch. I expect, and this really happened, I expect the instruction to be literal word meanings. It's not a good time to play games with the customer to see if he can figure out how to set the time with cute and clever sayings or metaphors. I was just trying to set my watch the other day because we went from Satan to regular time to daylight saving time. And I read this page with real small print. And which button to push, they were trying to be as clear as possible. But I knew one thing, that I had to read it literally if I was going to set my watch. Okay? And we laugh at that, but it is so fundamentally true of the scripture that it's laughable that they don't get it. Okay. Now, what if the new watch owner did not know what time it was? I'm setting my watch on what time it is. What do I set? His task becomes impossible without another clock showing him the time and a little text to explain how to set the watch, he'd totally gone. Remember, that's how they see the Bible. They don't know what time it is. They don't know how to set the watch. It just, what is it? It's just stuff. And whatever hits you is okay. Furthermore, I got things to do. Now, perhaps we could improve our picture by saying that the Lord gave us the watch, set the time, and all we need to do is look at it and tell the time because it's set and it tells us the right time. So if you ignore the watch hands, the thing is useless to you. So the Bible must be read for its literal clarity, else, how else? Not right sentence. Okay, literal Bible is a heresy. Now, this is written by James Barr, now deceased. All these guys are dead already. All know better. They haven't agreed yet, but they're no better, some of them. You don't really read the Bible literally, do you? I can hear the disdain in the voice. And I got this personal beef a little bit with interpretation. I don't like to use the word interpretation because I don't think the Bible is subject to interpretation. Parts of it is, but not the Bible. The Bible is a clear revelation of God. And if we give in to the idea that we interpret the Bible, then everybody says, well, I interpret it my way, you interpret your way, and so we interpret literally. Well, if you don't interpret literally, then you don't have to interpret what's clear. You just read it. All right, so that's kind of my pet peeve. Now, this guy, James Barr, quoted by Wilkerson in his book, if dispensationalism is not a heresy, then nothing is heresy. In comparison with it, many of the traditional deviations commonly branded as heretical, such as plagianism, that's the man hasn't fallen, monophysism, that you know, the person of Christ, how you describe him, that's Nerastrum, it's the same thing, and the like, are no more than minor disturbances in the flow of the entire doctrinal current of Christianity. It's that dispensationalism is the biggest heresy. These others that are really heresies, they're nothing. So dispensation is more like the Gnostic among the traditional heresies in that it creates almost an entire new mythology of its own. So all these things we think about the future are mythological ideas. Through this mythology takes the outward form of, and he says, biblical interpretation. See, that's why I don't like him to use that word. Outward biblical readings. You read the Bible literally and you come up with these mythological statements. Think about my watch instructions again. Mr. Barr, please step forward. How do we read your books or your comments about dispensationalism? If you are not literal, how are we to read and understand you? So we use your despised literal hermeneutic when reading your writings, but cannot when reading God's? Well, this man is a professor of vocabulary and structure of the Hebrew language. If anybody, he should know something about words and the meanings of it. Okay, that's one side. We're back into the Bible. We haven't understood what it says yet, but we're at least opening the book. Now, when we're in the Bible, we notice something about the Jews in prophecy. That's the second part that we get out of the French Revolution. Didn't start it there, but it got a big push. So look again at Jews and prophecy. As we, with all considerations, the lines or layers between these events, like I talked to you about last week, and the people in theologies are not ever completely clean. So we have Jews, interest in Jews already, but when we get a current going, that's what we're talking about. So here too, we see that some Puritans were described as premillennial and some kind of expectation of Zionism, anachronism word, didn't use that yet. But in terms of a lasting movement that provided an enduring current of thought, we need to go to a pre-Darby personality in England, not very much sooner than Darby, Lewis Way. The origin of the second aspect of the 19th century millennial revival, renewal of interest in the Jewish state of the Jews, can be traced almost directly to the intriguing eccentricities of Lewis Way. Trained as a barrister, which means lawyer, he was dramatically enriched in 1809 with the bequest of £300,000. You know how much that money would be? That'd be millions of dollars. I mean, probably 20 millions. I mean, a lot of money. So he got this bundle of money, and he got it from a guy named John Way, who was first attracted to Lewis Way by the accidental similarity of their names. So he was released. So he took this money and he bought stuff. Released from the bondage of an irksome profession, as Way wrote, he purchased Stanstead Park near Emsworth, Sussex, still apparently is a place, and set about fulfilling the role as a gentleman. Although he spent £150,000 on his estate and another £1,200 on deer, should come to Nebraska, he could have gone for free, he professed an obligation to philanthropy and Christian service, with the idea of Christian service, and he's heading toward the Jews. His interest in the condition of the Jews in Europe was aroused when, in 1811, when visiting Devonshire, he was told about a grove of trees that were not to be cut down until the restoration of the Jews to Palestine occurred. The owner of the wood had left a will which contained the clause, "These oaks shall remain standing, and the hand of man shall not be raised against them until Israel returns and is restored to the land of promise." Isn't that interesting? Somebody had made a commitment of his life and made a statement with it. Stimulated by this strange expression, Lewis Way began to investigate both the ancient prophecies related to the restoration of the Jews and the contemporary agencies, the groups that were devoting their attention to this problem. He discovered the existence of a faltering group named the London Society of Promoting Christianity Among the Jews, the LSPCJ. Mr. Wilkinson talks about that quite a bit in his book. Founded in 1809, so see, it's only been in existence for 2 years, led by this Fry, who was a converted Jew. So he turns to this organization, and I'll just better read it to you. Concerned only with the proselytizing of the London Jews in his, as a missionary society, devoted to the training and support of Jewish converts to Christianity. So the climax of this venture occurred when Wei was introduced to Tsar Alexander I and influenced him to submit a memorandum of the condition of the Jews in the European powers that were assembled at the Congress of Aix-la-Chapelle in 1818. Now, the Jews, depending on who were the, drew the boundaries, they were in Russia or they're in Prussia. So this time must have been Russia. But the restoration of the Jews to Palestine, the return of Joseph's people to the Promised Land, became firmly established as the plank in the millenarian creed. Then through its monthly issues of the Jewish Expositor, the Journal, and dozens of other books, his question was discussed in never-wearying detail. The Zionist cause won rather wide sympathy at this time. Millenarian interest in the restoration of the Jews stemmed explicitly from the interpretation of prophecy. The prophetic text, which described the cataclysmic events apparently fulfilled in French Revolution, now we're going from historicism to futurism, and they had some things in common here. The prophetic text, which described the cataclysmic events apparently fulfilled in the French Revolution, also predicted the second advent of Christ and the restoration of the Jews. That's the touch point. The prophetic timetable had joined these expectations inextricably. The millennium accepted both events as the will of God, prayed for the coming of both, and if he could not work for the accomplishment of the second advent, did what he could to cause the Palestinian resettlement by the Jews. But there can be no question the millenarian movement played a significant role in preparing the British for political Zionism, which would be about 100 years later. So we have the thread of connection. The Society of Investigating the Prophecy was founded by 1826 by Ferrer and Louis Wei. And then the bottom, the Prophetic Conference in London in 1826, was set up by Harry Drummond, another name you'll see a lot if you read the history, who was influenced by Irving, who was, by the way, the original Seventh-day Adventist guy, which kind of drifted off, and Wei. Much later, first National Prophetic Conference in the United States was held in 1878, and we get into these later on, the Niagara of the Lake conferences, which I think we are the benefactors of, because the pastors went there to be trained or to discuss issues. So back in England, we have the Asbury Conference, 1825-30. The issues in this conference, second event ahead of the millennium, the question of the 1260-year or day issue, the French Revolution, and the pessimistic attitude towards culture, the separation of the churches from the mainline churches, a preliminary eminency, the second advent, conversion of Jews, so forth, the spiritual gifts questions came up. These are things that we're very comfortable talking about. The only one that's a little odd is the one on the 1260 years, and I think they end up rejecting that. So another one you hear a lot about, the Powers Court Conference. This is from Sandine, the second book up that I showed you. And this is a really interesting statement here. Remember, I don't think he's a believer, but it is very positive towards Darby, as has been true so frequently in history of religious controversy. Futurism did not become a real threat to the historicist and an attractive alternative prophetic position until accepted by believers. When believers start believing something, it's kind of like an election. People get elected. You know, you don't have to have the campaigns. You know, it's just somehow the way the Lord works through the mind of believers, through the power of the Spirit. There's a common understanding by believers of what's right. So this occurred when Darby, Newton, and the Plymouth Brethren adopted futurism. Of course, they were out preaching and teaching it too, but the people had to buy into it or else it wouldn't have gone anywhere. Okay, John Nelson Darby, GNRB, a lawyer by training, very brilliant mind, spent a lot of time on his biography, a disappointment to his father for not being a barrister, not a lawyer, although he was trained for one, an Irish student of Christianity, ordained a Church of England priest who found saving faith during a convalescent period after a fall from his horse, 1827. But he's very steeped into the Bible and so forth. It wasn't like he started from scratch there. Darby was born in London in a prominent Anglo-Irish family. Darby received the best education possible. He attended London's Westminster School until his parents moved to an ancestral castle in Ireland. He graduated from Dublin College and so forth as a gold medalist, which is a scholar. Continued his studies in law, being admitted to the Irish Chancellery Bar, never practiced. Tommy Ice. Jan Darby's pretribulationalism appeared as a seminal idea from his own Bible study. This becomes an issue because everybody wants to know, where did you get that from? Where did you get that from? Where did you get that from? Well, I got it from the Bible. No, you couldn't have got that from the Bible. Everybody gets something from somebody else. And I'm sometimes so irritated that why can't a guy read the Bible for himself and say, there he could see it? You know, but so everyone wants to know where he got her from. And Darby hit sticks with it. I'm a man of the book. I didn't read the other guy's stuff. I read the Bible. Okay, and I don't think it's that difficult. I mean, it's got some problems doing that, but, you know, you read Daniel 9, you get the 70 weeks down and all that kind of stuff. It's not that hard from our standpoint of view. Somebody did the work. All right, so it seemed to be a seminal idea from his own Bible study during the convalescent period in December 1827. Darby wasn't addressed about issues regarding to the true nature of the purpose of the church. He was in the liberal church, which led to the ideas of the rapture of the church and ecclesiastical and eschatological issues. They're very much tied together. Stunt concludes, we must emphasize that Darby was a very complex person whose understanding of scripture and theology was continually evolving. And they want to make a point of this, that, well, he's not really, you know, he's always evolving. But when Darby was done, I'll say this later if I get to it, is that when I was done, he said, my basic views did not change from those 1828 days. No doubt they were questioned. People talked about it. And he said, well, what do you think about this? There was discussion going on. But his views didn't change. Remember, he got it from the Bible. So Darby possessed the intellect, and this is where he's good at, and this is what he provides for us. He had the intellect, the education, the capability needed to for original thinking, and the discipline to develop ideas into a system. Okay, that's what we have. It's a system that's based on the Bible. There's nothing in the record that indicates that this was not what he, in fact, did do. Through Darby's personal testimony, on multiple occasions, he provided a theological rationale to support pre-tribulationalism, something that would be unlikely if he got the idea stolen from another source. I mean, if you steal an idea, you got the idea, but you can't explain how you got to it. But if you explain how you got to it, then you promise your idea, right? Okay, there's no question that Jan Darby made a mark in Christian history. It is to his credit that the import of the import of literal reading of the Bible has clarified 15 centuries of anti-Semitism and Hellenized Christianity. It is no wonder that when the draining of the theological swamp, all the little critters that have been upset make their way to the surface and bitterly attack the persons. And that's exactly what has happened, is happening. So the demons wake up, all right? It takes about 5 seconds to find these invectives flying at the speed of light, intending to discredit dispensational premillennialism by the association of Darby with other proven heretics, even to the vision-seeing 16-year-old lunatic girl, which I don't think she was that, but that's how they make her. If that does not work, attack the possibility that someone could possibly get something out of the Bible on their own. Now, that's a last resort. That is, that it was, if not original, the rediscovery of biblical doctrines. He didn't make it up. He just got out of the Bible. Now, I got some things here I'd like to finish with you. These are statements that people made about Darby. In the words of Ernest Sandin, he says, Jan Darby deserves better treatment from the historians than he's received, either from those who appraised him or those who have reviled him. The assessment of his career has not been objectively written or the scope of his influence adequately appreciated. Then I said, but now we have Wilkinson's book For Zion's Sake. Darby saw history as a progressive revelation. His system sought to explain the stages in God's redemptive plan in the universe, called progressive revelation. There's nothing especially radical about dividing history into periods. Covenantalists like Cosicius had done the very thing. Dispensations are not what marked Darby off from the rest of the theologies. What separated Darby's dispensationalism was his novel, their word, method of Bible interpretation. Novel Bible interpretation, folks, is just reading it. That's why I hate the word interpretation. He didn't interpret the Bible, he just read it. That which is clear doesn't need to be interpreted. Method of Bible interpretation, which consisted of strict literalism, that's okay, an absolute separation of Israel and the church, that's true, which results in the two distinct people of God, and the separation of these people at the rapture and the second coming of Christ. All right, he said that Christ will come for his saints. At the second coming, he will come with his saints. That's how we say it. Another repeated charge against Darby is unsettled position, supposedly to make him look weak, so weak on the verge of denying the faith, or whatever evil thought this may conjure up. While Darby did make some remarks that one might think that he was unsure of the rapture, for example, but being challenged and being open to correction is always a good trait of godliness, is it not? In the end, Darby confesses, once he had came to the conclusions in the late 1820s, early 30s, that he did not change his views. It is very hard to make corrections to unestablished belief system, I say. That's what they say to us. Do not read your Bible literally. How is it possible to maintain any revelation of God if it is pliable and flexible as allegory would have it be? For them, the Bible is the Bible plus my the formula is the Bible plus my thoughts equals the truth, and you know the error in that. Why would anybody associate literal meanings with lunacy? On the contrary, when these attacks of literalism come, we ought to rejoice and recognize the work of the Spirit who convicts the guilty and the demonic world that has just been disturbed. One of the great challenges of dispensational premillennialism faces is the lingering influence of Hellenistic Christianity, the ideas of Greek philosophy lingering into Christianity. I believe that Darby unknowingly retained some Hellenization. 3 points I want to mention. I just want to point this out. To be fair, you got to talk about the good and the bad. I mean, not everybody will not necessarily agree with me on this one. While he returned the kingdom promises to the Jews, as in the Messianic millennium, he retained the idea of a kingdom in the spiritual world. He retained the idea of the kingdom and spiritual world. This spiritualized kingdom is reality, in reality, no different than the covenantal idea of a kingdom in the space. You know, Jesus is our king today. However, in the covenantalist theology, there is no earthly kingdom ever. So there's a difference. Although the aspect of the spiritualized kingdom is the same. Darby, which was the way it was, he inherited that, I think. Darby speaks to the church as a heavenly people, whereas the Jews are the earthly people. We don't talk about the church as heavenly people. We're all bound for the kingdom. So the joining of these kingdoms, I think, in his writing is somewhat ambiguous, and maybe I could read a lot more, and maybe I find it clarified. But it seems like he sets us up for that problem. Then along these lines, the earth takes on an evil character to be destroyed before the eternity where the sublime begins. That's Platonic Augustinianism, this where the sublime is after the material has been destroyed. All three of these deviations are rooted in Platonic Greek idea that matter is evil and the spiritual is good. The church never seems to partake of the evil earth, has a heavenly destination, and the Jews will be delivered from the evil earth at the end of the millennium. So I think this is where I think he's just a little bit weak. So the correction is that the Greek idea from an evil earth is, in fact, an earth to be restored, regenerated, and made new, not discarded. The church in Israel will enjoy the earthly kingdom with the Jews. The tribulation survivors, which are Jews and Gentiles, are at home in the earth, while the church and the resurrected saints, the Jews and Gentiles, live in the New Jerusalem associated with the earth over which the church will rule and reign. I think that's more or less the way we teach it. So the common correction, or slight correction, should not discourage us with Darby, because he clarified the bigger issues, the understanding of the seventh week of Daniel, the tribulation of the week, 70th week, the rapture before the seventh week, the earthly kingdom promised to the Jews and the Gentiles, and then most of all, which gives us this, a little reading of the text makes all this possible. In 1654, 23 Sephardic immigrants arrived in New York. In the same year, Manasseh ben Israel petitioned Oliver Cromwell to admit the Jews to England. Same year, 1564. It was unclear, however, which nation would prove to be the staunchest ally of the Jewish people. Following Britain's abdication of responsibility and her betrayal of the Jewish people during the Mandate period, it fell to America to assume the role of patron Israel. So the patronage was given voice in 2001 by the newly elected President George W. Bush, who declared, "I am a Christian, but I believe with the psalmist that the Lord God of Israel neither slumbers nor sleeps. My administration will be steadfast in supporting Israel against the terrorism and violence and in seeking the peace for which all Israelis pray." Dispensationalism has endured in the United States because it was able to create a new subculture among evangelical leaders who were happy to adopt Darby's eschatology while remaining within their own denominations. Dispensationalism is not a denominational issue. It's across many denominations. So forget that. Such men founded Bible colleges, institutes, theological seminaries, which expounded dispensational tribulation and laid a firm Christian Zionist foundation within the American Evangelical Church. As one notable critic of dispensationalism conceded, of all people, George Elton Ladd, which I will do a lesson on him. Gil mentioned him last Sunday night. I think it was last Sunday night. He's a worth study. Now, he says this, and he was out to destroy dispensationalism. He says this about Darby. It is doubtful if there had ever been any circle of men who have done more by their influence in preaching and teaching and writing to promote the love of Bible study, a hunger for the deeper Christian life, a passion for evangelism and zeal for missions in the history of American Christianity than John Nelson Darby. That's incredible, I think. So the very ethos of the United States enabled an unassuming Irish clergyman to lay the foundations for a distinct form of evangelicalism which has greatly impacted American Christianity. By heralding the any moment rapture of the church, this is Wilkinson, by the way, the national restoration of Israel and the second coming of Jesus, John Nelson Darby raised a banner of true biblical truth in the 19th century beneath which successive generations of true believers have rallied. So here we sit tonight as benefactors, I believe, of the work of John Nelson Darby.